Wondery Plus subscribers can listen to The Vanished ad-free right now. Join Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or Apple Podcasts.
At this point, they've been living this way without answers for so many years. It's almost probably to the point of almost acceptance or just something that they've lost hope with in time. Things were different then. Law enforcement wasn't as diligent with it as they are now. Families weren't really coming forward either at the time. The reports aren't what they are now. And I learned just from other tips that I spoke to with families that have, you know, approached me as being interested in this Jane Doe as potentially being their missing children. The answers that I'm getting from them, that they didn't report them missing to the police. They did in other cases, and the police didn't follow up with it. They didn't go too far with the case. But then again, it was back in the 1976 time frame where there wasn't much to go off of. You know, as I get these new leads, the media attention really reached out and got the phones ringing and speaking to the families. You know, you feel sympathy for all of them going through the same situation, wanting closure. Their loved ones have been missing for years, and they're just hoping that this is their daughter. And, you know, I've had several conversations where I want to tell them, you know, I want to help all of you, and I hope that you're able to come up with something. I hope that you're going to find a match somewhere with DNA. If it's not with this one, I'm hoping within the system it's going to work out. And, you know, just outpouring support from them, too. A lot of kind words. The families are saying how much they appreciate the work we're doing and thanks for not giving up. And, I mean, that says a lot.
On October 2nd, 1976, a farmer and his young granddaughter were riding a tractor through the fields of Seneca, Illinois. The farmer saw what he thought to be a deer lying in a ditch and wanted to show his granddaughter. But as he approached, he found a young woman, nude, her head covered in a sweater and garbage bags. The farmer drove back home and notified authorities. Soon after, the Grundy County Sheriff's officers arrived and found a young black woman dead of a gunshot wound to the head in an unincorporated part of Grundy County. Authorities tried to identify the woman, but no one came forward, and they were unable to match her to any missing persons reports. 6 weeks later, on Thanksgiving Day, she was buried in an unmarked grave in a local cemetery. 43 years later, she remains unidentified. On this episode of The Vanished, we are taking a look at the other side of missing persons cases, the unidentified. I'm Marissa, and from Wondery, this is episode 161 of The Vanished, the story of Grundy County Jane Doe. Audible offers thousands of popular favorites, exclusive new series, guided wellness programs, comedy, and exciting new voices in audio. As an Audible member, you can choose one title a month to keep from their entire catalog. The Audible app makes it easy to listen anytime, anywhere, while traveling, working out, walking, doing chores, you decide. I like to listen a little bit each evening while I'm cooking dinner, and it's great for my evening walks too. Recently, I've been listening to Lay Them to Rest by Laura Norton. It's a fantastic audiobook. You don't want to miss it. New members can try Audible free for 30 days. Visit audible.com/MIA or text MIA to 500-500. That's audible.com/MIA or text MIA to 500-500. We've all seen and heard about the recent spike in resolutions to cold cases thanks to DNA testing. So much has changed in the world since 1976. Forensic science 4 decades ago was not much more than dental exams and fingerprints. Some early blood testing was in practice, but it didn't do much more than identify the sex or blood type of the victim. Today, we are telling the story of Jane Doe in the hope that she will soon be reunited with her family and given her name back. Grundy County, Illinois is a small county southwest of Chicago. The area is filled with fields and farmland, a far cry from the busy metropolitan areas in adjacent counties. On October 2, 1976, a farmer in Seneca, Illinois encountered a woman's body. Her head was wrapped in a plastic bag and a sweater. She was dead of a gunshot wound to the head. It appeared as though the bag had been placed over her head before she was shot. There was a hole in the bag and a casing found inside. The plastic was taped around her head with electrical tape, and then a red, white, and black sweater was wrapped around the bag. It was estimated that she had been killed within the 24 hours prior to the discovery of her body. There was very little forensic evidence to be examined at the scene. They did note that the sweater that was wrapped around her head still had a partial price tag attached. It said $15.99. There was also a half-empty bottle of TJ Swan wine, but it's unclear if this was related to Jane Doe. She did have a scar on her upper right thigh that appeared to have been there for quite some time. Her teeth appeared to have been well cared for, and they noted that she had not been pregnant recently. They took vaginal swabs that were negative for seminal plasma and male reproductive cells. The farmer who found Jane Doe stated that he had been up and down the road 6 or 7 times that day, but didn't notice anything in the ditch. He hadn't seen or heard anything suspicious the night before, but he did mention that his dog had been barking a lot around midnight 2 nights prior, but he didn't know why his dog seemed so upset. In Jane Doe's file, there's a report about some found property. Jane Doe was found on October 2nd, and on December 18th, a bag was found nearby, and it was believed that the items inside could have belonged to her, but there's no way to know for sure. Inside the bag was a bra, 2 pairs of underwear, a tattered skirt, a pair of patent leather high heels, a pair of pantyhose, and 2 other pairs of pantyhose that were each tied into 2 loops in a way that resembled rope restraints. They noted that it was similar to a pair of handcuffs because of the distance between the loops. They were never able to figure out for sure that these items belonged to her, but it's understandable why they suspected they could have been hers, since they were found nearby and the pantyhose that looked like restraints could have been used when she was murdered. Back in 1976, they thought that Jane Doe was between 18 and 23 years of age, but she was recently exhumed, which we will get into a bit more later. When they exhumed her, they expanded her possible age range to between 15 and 27 years old at the time of her death. After Jane Doe was found, the investigators did everything they could think to do at the time. Missing persons lists were scoured, an artist rendering of Jane Doe was posted on television and in the newspapers. But there were no solid leads. They got some tips saying that she was a local sex worker, but they were able to determine that she wasn't any of the women mentioned by these tipsters. So without any claims to this woman, officials had her buried and put the case on a shelf. For this episode, I spoke to several people who are working diligently to determine who Jane Doe is. Brandon Johnson is the deputy coroner for Grundy County, Illinois. He's the one who initially contacted me asking if I'd be willing to cover a Jane Doe case. I said, of course, it's been something that I've wanted to do since I started the show. Brandon is very committed to giving Jane Doe her name back. When we spoke with him, we asked him how he became involved with identifying the unidentified.
I started as an emergency medical technician, paramedic. I spent time once I became a paramedic, I took a job with the body removal service in Chicago, and I worked for them. We had the contract for the city of Chicago. I worked there for a year, and we constantly responded to, I worked 12-hour shifts there, partnered up. We constantly report to death investigation scenes. I could be going to homicide scenes, hospitals, unclaimed, natural, accidents, everything, any scene. And merely, I was just there to transport them to the medical examiner's office. I had no responsibilities of investigating. I was just there to basically bag them and transport them to the ME's office where there would be an autopsy. So I became interested in that, seeing, you know, the beginnings of things. I'd go there, I'd seen autopsies before. I'd responded to deaths as a paramedic. I'd always had an interest in putting the puzzle pieces together. So over time, the drive up there got to be too much. I mean, I was very busy up there. I saw a lot of interesting cases, but down here I knew our corner and it was closer to home. I live in the county. He gave me a shot on it and I took off running. My interest was obviously the investigations. I wanted to be involved in anything I could get my hands on, you know, get my feet wet in this new investigative part. You know, I got to see things through from the beginning to the end instead of just dropping somebody off at the morgue.
Brandon told us what he knows from Jane Doe's initial autopsy report.
At the time of autopsy there in 1976, it was determined that the female unidentified had died as a result of the laceration of the brain with multiple fractures of the skull due to a gunshot wound to the head, which nowadays we would just say a gunshot wound to the head. In 1976, it was a little bit different. The matter of death was ultimately ruled a homicide. She was found deceased in a ditch, nude, covered with a sweater. I believe the only color photo we had was the autopsy photo. The scene photos were all black and white. Everything was just different. The reports were, you know, typed or handwritten in some cases. The autopsy itself was at a funeral home. Now it's always at a coroner's office or a medical examiner's office with, you know, a forensic pathologist, something that wasn't really around back then either. A forensic pathologist is beneficial with homicide cases especially. Just all sorts of improvements with CSI, the crime lab, DNA, and just so much forensic testing. At this point, when we took a fresh look at this again, I want to say it's been about almost a year now that we've been working on this. We had approached the sheriff's office at the time, and there was really nothing for them to pursue. We were purely working this case as an unidentified case to try and make an identification. They were not going to reopen the criminal investigation at the time. There are no cold case detectives within the county. There's a few detectives on the sheriff's department, detective sergeant, and there's no other specialists at all in our area. I've had discussions with the Illinois State Police crime lab, some crime scene investigators. They did offer assistance with taking a look at things. I've spoke with, you know, many professionals across the board that have expressed interest. The future is looking bright. We spent almost a year on this now, and everything's finally just really pulling through. We're seeing results. We're seeing what's been done. At this point, we wait anxiously on any word back from the University of North Texas, any leads to pan out.
We also spoke to Chief Coroner John Callahan for this episode. He started his career in the funeral industry more than 40 years ago, and we wanted to know why this Jane Doe was probably not reported missing, as officials at the time could find no matching missing persons.
We had, you know, skeletal remains found of a young girl that had been missing for 3 years, and she wasn't reported missing for about 2 to 3 weeks, only because, and she was only 17, but she lived the lifestyle of running with some older men, boyfriends, and not coming home from a week or two at a time. So I just think it's perhaps their lifestyle that takes them to that. I mean, they just don't check in with family members. They're not active with their family for days and weeks upon at a time. And so that's why families don't get excited or call police, because they haven't heard from them, because it's just their normal way of life. Back then, there was a lot of houses, bars that would have a lot of ladies working, whether it was stripping or beyond that even. It was just prevalent back then. There were several places here in Grundy County that had them. So, you know, they could be ladies that were traveling from the bigger cities, because I imagine 40 years ago, the black ratio here in Grundy was probably slim to none. Obviously, that's changed today, but the location of her body to the interstate was basically a mile in a straight shot. You exit the interstate and drive straight south, and the first big turn in the road, which is all timber out in that area, that's where she was. And based on the evidence and the reports and such, you know, it appears that she was dumped there and not, you know, not actually killed there.
Last November, the coroner's office received approval from state authorities to exhume Jane Doe. They were very concerned that the casket and other materials would no longer be intact, but were surprised to find the remains were in excellent condition.
So we were just going by some notes that the funeral home that the coroner back then actually owned, there were some notes of what they'd had done. So they, in the notes, they'd referred to a Ziegler case, which is just a real thin metal case, and it has, you know, like 30 screws on the lid, and they were made for the purpose of shipping people out of the country, and so it met customs requirements and such. So that's all they placed her in, and she was embalmed, so that was good. But they just placed her in that and then placed her in the ground without putting her into a vault, which is a concrete structure and seals airtight and watertight. But she wasn't, so obviously the metal deteriorated a little bit. There was actually a hole in the bottom of it, and moisture, you know, obviously was in there, and she was actually placed in a rubber body bag and then into the Ziegler case. The rubber had all deteriorated away, and basically all that was left was the skeletal remains. So we were very fortunate to be able to, you know, dig down until we touched the case, and then we went ahead and dug it by hand so we wouldn't damage anything. And then we were able to slip a couple straps underneath the unit and pick the whole thing up. So it was an exciting day, I have to say, because all I could picture is having to, you know, make screens up and sift dirt and all that type of thing. But that wasn't the case. So that was a good, you know, it was a good day. And then bringing her back here and methodically going through the remains and trying to collect all the bones we could collect. Again, we're talking about 41 years ago. I would have thought that the Ziegler case would have collapsed and, you know, deteriorated away where dirt was mixed in with the remains. And that wasn't the case. It was totally still structurally sound, except the very bottom underneath. But that didn't affect anything coming out of the hole. In fact, it kind of helped because the water drained out. So yeah, I couldn't have asked for anything more. You know, both mandibles were still intact with the skull. So I took that up to a couple of forensic odontologists and they worked it up and such. So it was, you know, that was a good day as well.
Brandon was also nervous about the condition they might find Jane Doe's remains in, but was happy that they now have more to work with than expected.
We've got good bones. We've got good hair that was still intact. You know, we're working with our pathologist, and she kind of helped us that day with the anatomy portion of it and how we're going to move forward with submitting the bones. With the initial impression from, you know, talking to other people, especially anthropologists at UNT, they were telling me conditions of what they found after 20 years, so I was already expecting, you know, the worst case scenario. I was expecting water would be, you know, overloaded in that grave. The bones, I obviously knew wouldn't be damaged, but I just hoped that they would still be there. No animals would have got to them. There wouldn't be water damage from them. But I didn't expect to have any hair to work with. I'm really surprised it wasn't, the torso wasn't more skeletalized, and the skull, everything was just remarkable. We didn't have straightforward and a gunshot wound. It was a little hard to, you know, determine that. You could see where a fracture was, as a pathologist pointed out, but really couldn't find the gunshot itself. Not what I would have expected. It could have been more of a smaller caliber or a 38. I'm starting to question if it was a 38 or not. But it would almost have been like a 22, you would think, just from looking at the skull. So there was a little break there. The only thing, once we did have it, over time, the teeth held up pretty well. One tooth did fall out, but it maintained in close proximity within the casket. So we still had all teeth recovered. Only one tooth had fallen off the gums or mandible, if you will. Nothing changed. We saw what was, you know, done back then as far as embalming and placing, you know, the fluids in the casket with them, and just the techniques that they did back then to sew. No forensic clues for us. Obviously, we can't We can't do a sex assault kit at this point. You can't do nail clippings. There's a lot of things that have kind of been taken away from us with such a time delay.
When this case was reopened, state law enforcement officials attempted to obtain a DNA profile from the sweater found on Jane Doe. However, the DNA profile was a mixture and was not suitable for entry into the National DNA Database, CODIS. This complicated the investigation because there have been a few people who thought she might be their loved one, but the DNA didn't match. One of these people is a woman in nearby Englewood, Illinois. She believes that Jane Doe is her missing daughter, Shirley. Now in her 80s, this mom says that she remembers buying a sweater similar to the one found on Jane Doe. And she says that she did report her daughter missing and provided pictures to the local police. But the police were unable to find any record of her being reported missing. She keeps a composite sketch of Jane Doe hung on her wall, and she gave a DNA sample to state law enforcement, where an attempt was made to compare the swab to the blood DNA on the sweater. Test results were inconclusive. Is it possible that the DNA they obtained from the sweater isn't Jane Doe's? Coroner Callahan spoke about his office's work with this woman who believes that Jane Doe is her daughter.
The lady we went up and saw in Englewood outside of Chicago, she had a picture on the wall that was based on the superimposed pictures and sketches that we have gotten over the years, but she truly has a lot of resemblance, and that she recognized the sweater. You know, we spent a couple hours with her, and she was just so hopeful that this would bring some closure to her, and that we took swabs of her. She's about 84, 85, and she just swore up and down this is her daughter. And, you know, we ran it through the state lab, and it did not come up a match. But I still don't think that we have, from the sweater, good DNA. I think that when the femur gets processed and we get the DNA from that, I don't know. I get, maybe I'm just being too hopeful here, but I just feel so much more comfortable that it's being done with the real valuable bone being the femur versus just a sweater that's been kept in a damn plastic bag in a plastic container for 40 years. And so I think Brandon actually spoke to her and to tell her that the results from the state lab were inconclusive and, you know, we haven't shut the light out. I mean, we still have hope. So we're hoping that we can get things done in Texas and while she's still alive and, you know, whether it's yes or no, I don't know, you know, so I would give anything to be able to go back up there and say, yes, we've brought this. This is her, you know, I would love to. This lady in Englewood, she couldn't recall names or anything, but she said her daughter ran with some rough people and she thought one of them had been in prison. Who knows?
Until she was recently exhumed, it was impossible to know if the blood on the sweater belonged to her, but the coroner's office hopes that DNA from her femur will be entered into the National DNA Database as soon as the testing is completed. We asked Coroner Callahan to share what kind of evidence was preserved and how the blood from the sweater was examined by state authorities.
We started going through, you know, what evidence that they had, which it 40 years ago, I mean, they didn't do it like they do today. So obviously what we had to work with was, you know, very small. But, you know, we got all the reports and photographs that were taken back then and such, and kind of just started building our own case here. And then at the time we initiated that, you know, all we basically had was some DNA on a sweater, which, you know, was questionable at best. According to the reports, they indicate that there was a vial of blood taken for storage, but we haven't even located that. And the sweater, which had evidence of blood on it, was basically just in a plastic container along with the actual reports, binders, photographs, and it was in one of the larger tubs, and it was actually commingled with some other cases. So again, you know, going back to they may have done 40 years ago as to what we do today is like night and day. Obviously, cases are kept, especially homicides, kept totally separate. And, you know, evidence with blood on it would be stored more correctly in a paper bag. And the vial of blood would have been, is, I mean, we've had other homicides since, but I mean, they're kept in refrigeration, so there's no blood breakdown and such. So I'm not condemning the way they did things 40 years ago, because I'm not sure, you know, what type of training they would have had back then. But I think there is a lot, there's definitely a lot to be learned from this.
Coroner Callahan also shared some of the practices that have changed in how homicides are processed and evidence is preserved since he started working in the field in the 1970s.
Back in the 70s, and even when I started in law enforcement, I started in law enforcement in 79, and it was not uncommon to go to autopsies in garages of funeral homes or in their preparation room where they do the embalmings, which the lighting is a lot to be desired. There's no containment, shall I say, of other individuals coming in and out because it is a funeral home, so they have a business to conduct. So there's a lot of possibilities that can unfortunately happen security-wise and such. And so today, I mean, I don't know of any pathologists that I'm in touch with that will even do an examination in a garage or a funeral home. They prefer the forensic morgues, which we're very fortunate here in Grundy to have. And so the examinations are done under a much more controlled environment. Air ventilation, lighting, the capabilities of x-rays on hand, just night and day, quite honestly. Because, I mean, back in the, when I first started, I was involved as a deputy sheriff with examinations that were done in funeral homes and garages. Especially, you know, garages, when I say that, I'm referring to cases where a decomp, where there's odor. So the funeral directors or funeral home owners didn't want that in their preparation room. So we would actually do it in a garage. And here, you know, again, it's in so much different. And then not only that, the evidence that's collected today stays right here until the appropriate location for that evidence to be shipped or hand delivered is taken place. I can recall back in the, again, back in the 70s when an examination was done at a funeral home. So that meant everyone, the coroner, the pathologist, the police officers, and whoever was involved in the investigation had to basically travel there, bring their own supplies, and then leave that facility with their supplies, their evidence, and such. So then where does it go from there? Does it go home with the person for that evening until he comes back to work tomorrow? You know, all that type of thing.
We all know there are things in life that you have to compromise on, but when it comes to your health, there's no compromise. So don't settle for that one doctor that isn't really addressing your needs. Instead, check out ZocDoc, the place where you can find and book doctors who will make you feel comfortable. And you can even search by location, availability, and insurance. ZocDoc is a free app and website where you can search and compare highly rated in-network doctors near you and instantly book appointments with them online. Once you find the doc you want, you can book them immediately. You can filter specifically for ones who take your insurance, are located near you, and treat basically any condition you're searching for. The typical wait time to see a doctor booked on ZocDoc is between just 24 and 72 hours. That's it. I use this, and you should too. Go to ZocDoc.com/vanished and download the ZocDoc app for free. Then find and book a top-rated doctor today. That's ZocDoc.com/vanished. ZocDoc.com/vanished. This message is sponsored by Greenlight. When you're a parent, you'll have your fair share of big talks with your kids. One of those big talks should involve money, and Greenlight can help with that. Greenlight is a debit card and money app for families. You can send your kids instant money transfers, get real-time notifications of spending, manage chores, and automate allowance. I've been using Greenlight with my older two kids for years. One thing that I love about it is that I can set up recurring or one-time chores, customized to my family's needs, and then my kids earn an allowance to reward them for a job well done. Not only does it motivate them to actually get the chores done, but it also teaches them a bit about financial literacy and independence. They're learning to earn, save, and spend wisely. So stop putting off the money talk and start putting your kids on the right path. Sign up for Greenlight today and get your first month free at greenlight.com/vanished. That's greenlight.com/vanished to try Greenlight for free. One more time, that's greenlight.com/vanished. When Jane Doe was killed in October of 1976, one of the most prolific serial killers in American history was in the middle of his nearly decade-long killing spree of young men not far away. John Wayne Gacy tortured and killed 9 teenage boys in nearby Chicago the same year that Jane Doe was murdered. In total, Gacy killed at least 33 teenage boys and young men. He wouldn't be arrested for another 2 years, but his crimes changed the way missing and unidentified cases are treated across the country. Today, 6 of Gacy's victims also remain unidentified. We spoke to Cook County Detective Sergeant Jason Moran for this episode. He's the lead detective working to identify the remainder of Gacy's victims, and he's also trying to assist in the identification of Grundy County Jane Doe. He spoke about what it's like to work on cold cases and the special challenges that come with working to identify the unidentified.
My name is Jason Moran. I'm a detective sergeant with the Cook County Sheriff's Police. I currently lead the Forensic Services Initiative, which is basically a cold case unit. I do old murders, old missing persons, human identification, which could mean flesh bodies or skeletal remains, body parts. I also work on complex death investigations. I work very closely with our medical examiner's office on these types of cases. I've been with the sheriff's office for 20 years and have been doing investigations for the vast majority of that time. I like the cold cases because, one, I think it's a underserved subfield of investigations. It just does not receive, in my opinion, the attention that it deserves. You know, if someone is murdered today or disappears under these suspicious circumstances today, we'll send out dozens and dozens of policemen to investigate. And that's fine. I don't disagree with that. I think it we have to. But once the case goes cold and investigative leads start running out or a new big case comes along, the cases sometimes become forgotten. And I just think that's unfortunate. So I don't think that someone that was murdered today is any more or less important than someone that was murdered 30 years ago. And but yet we countrywide, we put much more resources into the things that happen today and not much in the form of cold cases.
Detective Moran shared some of his experiences working the Gacy cases and how new policing and evidence preservation standards would hopefully prevent someone from remaining unidentified for 40 years today.
That's the one kind of unique part of working a serial killer case. The fact that Gacy had so many victims kind of provides a profile, a victim profile. And, you know, as opposed to a killer that maybe has one or two victims where the profile is harder to establish. With the Gacy case, because there were so many victims, you know, we know that Gacy killed at least 33 boys in a 6-year period. 1972 to 1978. When the sheriff and I decided to reopen the case, 25 of the 33 victims had been identified. So that was one of the first things I did when we decided to reopen the case, was to look at the 25 identified victims and learn about them. If you start to learn about them, you could see that Gacy was picking a similar type of victim. And I believe that's because these were sexually motivated crimes. So in other words, Gacy was picking boys that he was attracted to. And then the way we had to learn the way he was acquiring victims. And we knew that he was acquiring victims a few different ways. Juan Gacy owned a construction company called PDM, Painting, Decorating, and Maintenance. He would hire young men to do labor work. And some of his employees ended up being his victim. So we knew that, especially now when someone calls to talk about their missing loved one from so many years ago, you know, if they say, well, he worked in the construction business. Well, that's a tip or a clue, because we know that Gacy was killing some of his employees. Another way he would acquire victims is he would acquire young gay men, because he was gay himself. So if, and some of them were gay prostitutes and some weren't. And so if someone calls to talk about their missing loved one, they say, oh, well, we began to think, or we knew that he was homosexual. That's helpful. Also, he would pick up young men who were hitchhiking or on the bus. So many, many buses and trains come through Chicago, and the 70s, different time in our history, but a lot of people would hitchhike. So he would pick up hitchhikers, or he'd wait by bus stops and say, hey, do you need a ride? And some of those kids ended up becoming his victim. So there was definitely a connection to the 70s lifestyle and traveling through hitchhiking and buses and those types of things. But on the other hand, some of Gacy's victims were local boys. They were local kids, you know, especially Gacy's last victim, Robert Peast. This was a good kid from an average family, good people, had a job at a local pharmacy. Gacy was doing some work in the pharmacy, offered the kid a job, said, hey, why don't you come home with me? We'll get you lined up. And the kid was never seen or heard from again. There was kind of a balance between some of the kids were local and some of them were transient. From working very closely with our medical examiner's office, I know that we bury about 10 unidentified deceased a year. It still happens. And these could be body parts and skeletal remains. And, you know, there's still a handful, even with new protocols in place, DNA now being available. Now, my predecessors were primarily using dental records to identify Gacy's unidentified victims. DNA was not an option. It wasn't available. It wasn't even a thing. So even with DNA and some other sciences that we use and databases, that was another thing that my predecessors did not have a lot of. It was databases, you know, even NCIC, you know, the National Crime Information Center, that was relatively new, especially the missing persons category. It started in 1975. You know, we didn't have NAMIS and NCMEC and all these organizations now that assist law enforcement with these types of cases. So I would like to think that our, you know, our Jane Doe or the Gacy victims, if it happens, something like this happened today, we would have more identified, or it'd be easier to identify some of these people. But unfortunately, it still happens. And that goes back to what I was saying. It's weird to think, but some people slip through the cracks. They don't have anybody. Their lifestyle dictates that they're going to live anonymously, don't have large, close family bonds. It can happen. You know, people often ask me, could a serial killer like Gacy exist today that within 6 years have 33 male victims in one geographic area? In other words, not a traveling serial killer, a serial killer who stays in one area. I'd like to say no. I would like to say that with modern policing practices, that it would not take 33 victims before we locate the killer. The Cook County Medical Examiner's Office was having some issues a few years ago with bodies being stored in the morgue, and with some of the forensic resources that we were using on unidentified deceased person cases. So I was involved in drafting a protocol for these types of incidents. And really what it talks about, in short, it basically talks about the three main scientific ways to identify an unidentified deceased would be fingerprints, dental, and DNA. That, you know, within 24 hours, if the body is fleshed, fingerprints are taken and sent off to the lab to be analyzed. Within 30 days, dental records are taken, both charts and x-rays. Within 90 days, a biological sample from the decedent is sent off to the lab for DNA testing. And while all those scientific processes are going along, the police are doing the conventional police work, searching through missing persons bulletins, entering the decedent's demographics into missing person clearinghouses, putting out information about the unidentified decedent to try to obtain some info. So we're doing that now. These processes are taking place. The protocol even goes into some advanced processes like facial reconstruction. But the main thing for us here was our unidentified deceased were being buried after a certain amount of time in an unmarked hill of corpses where you couldn't find them again if you needed to do more scientific testing. This protocol basically says that at the end of all these processes, once fingerprints, dental, DNA, all the conventional police work is done, the DNA profiles have ran a full cycle through CODIS, that the ME's office and the law enforcement agency meet, talk about what else could be done, if anything. And if they both agree all of these items have been completed and there's still no identification, they both sign off on the burial of the decedent. But now the decedent goes into a single depth marked grave. And if in a year or two or five or 10, a cold case detective like me needs to get back to the body, we could find it again. So that's some of the things that we're doing here, and it's been helpful.
While speaking with Detective Moran, we asked him about some of the challenges in working on missing and unidentified persons cases. He shared some interesting insight about the limbo that families with missing loved ones live with every day.
Well, you know, I always talk about the, you know, long-term missing persons. I mean, I guess there's been a lot of very nice parts and then some tough parts as well. But long-term missing persons stick out in my mind because I've sat down with the families, dozens and dozens of families of long-term missing persons. And I always say that they're like the saddest people that you can meet. And that's because they live in a cruel limbo where they don't know what to think about their missing loved one. I've done dozens and dozens of death notifications also. Someone dies suddenly in a car crash, of a suicide, of a homicide, and a couple hours later, the police are knocking on the door, and a guy in the shirt and tie has to say, "I'm sorry to report, but your loved one is deceased. And this is what happened." I hate that part of detective work. I never like making death notifications. It's no different in cold cases, having to report to a family that their loved one was murdered by John Gacy is no easier than reporting to someone today that their loved one's dead. Death notifications are just awful. It's part of the job, but it's just awful. But the thing is, with death, we learn the circumstances surrounding the individual's passing. We could have services in the form of wakes and memorials and burials and cremations and churches. And there's a place to go to cry or to laugh, remembering the deceased loved one. It doesn't make it any easier. In fact, for many, it never goes away, the loss of a loved one. But eventually our minds wrap itself around death, that our bodies are going to die as the result of disease or trauma. Well, family members of long-term missing persons don't have that benefit. They don't have the benefit of knowing the circumstances surrounding their loved one's passing. All they have is questions. Where have they been for 10, 20, 30, 40 years? Are they dead? Are they alive? So, you know, some people have told me, "Oh, I thought my loved one may have had amnesia." They don't know. They live in a cruel limbo where they don't know what to think about their missing loved one. And as a result, it creates deep sadness they don't know what to do. I mean, what do you do with your loved one's bedroom if they've been missing for 30 years? I've had some missing family members of long-term missing persons tell me they wouldn't move for 20, 30, 40 years because they thought that their son or daughter who was missing would eventually remember and come back to the house, and then they would be gone because they would have moved and they would have missed the opportunity to reunite with their loved ones. So, you know, living in this cruel limbo with a long-term missing person, I think being able to help these families has probably been one of the most rewarding parts of doing cold case work or my career as a policeman. Even when the answers that you're providing are as tragic as your loved one has been killed by John Gacy, because the sheriff and I talked about this, about doing more harm than good. By reopening the case, are we doing more harm than good? Is learning that your loved one was killed by this evil man better than not knowing? And what we've learned is it is. Having the answer of what happened to their missing loved one, even if it's tragic, is better than not knowing, because your mind just plays horrible tricks on you.
Detective Moran told us that he has recovered some missing people alive and well, and has been able to reunite them with their family members. He's been working on cold cases for many years, and he values the technology we have today in forensics. But he has also found that established police methods still prove to be valuable in working on cold cases.
One missing person I thought was very likely to be a victim of John Gacy. But before I did the scientific work, I did the conventional work, and I was able to find him living in another state due to family problems, his own personal problems. He stayed away, but now he lives with his sister. You know, I was able to reunite them. They moved back together. His father was still alive, and they have a wonderful life together. So some of the missing person stories aren't even as that tragic. You know, they weren't killed by an evil man or died of other causes. They actually were alive. Some died of natural causes. I was able to find a certificate of death in their name. But any of those answers, to be able to sit down with these individuals after all these years, or even sometimes even to exclude them from the Gacy case. For 35 years, you thought that your loved one was one of Gacy's victims, but because you didn't have dental records, there was nothing you could do. But now we've just been able to say he's not one of Gacy's victims. He, you know, the last person to see him alive was not this evil killer.
Another interesting thing that Detective Moran shared is how the differences in our culture in the 1970s compared to today created the perfect opportunity for serial killers to commit their crimes and for their victims to remain unidentified.
You know, I always say it's cases like the Gacy case that kind of changed the way that society and law enforcement investigates certain incidences. So, you know, missing persons prior to the Gacy case, especially locally, was not a high priority. Many times, in fact, it was the norm. Families would come in and say, hey, my 16-year-old kid did not come home last night. I'd like to report a missing. And law enforcement would say, well, why don't you come back in 24, 48, 72 hours next week? If he's still missing, we'll take the report. But that's what these kids do nowadays. And it was, you know, the 70s sort of lent itself to the activities of serial killers. You know, this kind of loosey-goosey traveling around, the amount of drugs that was, you know, in society, you know, the put the thumb in the air and let's, you know, go to the beach for 2 weeks, you know, and not tell anybody where we're at. I always make a joke when I do presentations and other things where, because I remember, I mean, I'm not that old, but I mean, I remember being a kid in the 70s and looking at hitchhikers. It was common. Even in the 80s, it was common. But now I laugh because the drivers look at the hitchhiker like, I'm not letting him in my car. And the hitchhikers don't hitchhike anymore because they look at the guys in the car and go, I'm not getting in the car with him. The hitchhikers nor the drivers trust each other anymore. I never thought it was a great practice either. And I think it lent itself to people being harmed in certain ways. I mean, there was one way that Gacy acquired his victims. And then he would start grooming them as soon as he got them in the car. Is this someone that has a weak family bond? Is it someone that has a strong family bond? Is it someone where I could coax them into my house with drugs and alcohol? You know, maybe I could coax them to my house over a job offer, you know, and that's when that process started. And it's just unfortunate that these things happen. The Gacy case did change the way we do missing persons. There was no more wait 24, 48, 72 hours locally here. That ended. And another thing was law enforcement could not do a report saying that they located the missing persons unless they laid eyes on them, which was a big change from that time period, because what would happen back in the day is someone would be reported missing, a detective would be assigned the case, and sometimes, especially with juveniles, they would go, and we still do to this day, if there's a missing kid, we go and talk to their friends. And if one of the friends said, no, I saw a missing person yesterday at the corner store buying a pop, he was fine. Well, some detectives would consider that the missing person was located. In the Gacy case, a couple of those kids ended up being in the crawl space. So we don't do that anymore either. So sometimes these big cases, as tragic as they are, change the way society values their youth. Sometimes it changes the way law enforcement, their policies and procedures on those types of cases. And that was definitely true here.
Sometimes while researching a case, we encounter a police department that has a policy that they do not work with the media at all. Detective Moran believes that the relationship between law enforcement and the media is crucial.
I depend on the media for certain things. You know, when you do have a missing child, or you do have a missing person or unidentified deceased, or, you know, when you do a facial reconstruction on someone like Brandon's doing, you know, and you want to get it out, well, you depend on the media. It's one of those relationships where it's like sometimes, hey, I need some help on this case. You have a big pulpit. We need to get this information out to the public. And the media is the best way to do it.
One thing that often gets overlooked is the emotional toll that working these kinds of cases can take on those investigating them. I know that I feel it myself working on the show.
Sometimes you got to laugh to keep from crying, because these stories are tragic. These families are incredibly sad, and we deal with it every day. And if you don't laugh as a coping mechanism about silly things, the mental trauma would drive you crazy. In these cases, especially the cold cases, they stick with you. Learning the details of the case, meeting with families, and thinking about the victims and all the possibilities, and is there a killer out there still? And I mean, there's so many things that you got to find the little things that come along throughout the day that could bring a, you know, make you laugh a little bit, just to keep from crying, I always say.
While this story primarily focuses on the efforts to identify Jane Doe, I wanted to share with listeners what the Cook County Sheriff's Office would like anyone who thinks they might have information on a victim of John Wayne Gacy to do.
So what we're looking for is any missing male whites that went missing from the period of about 1970, 71 through 1979. And they were all about, the youngest of Gacy's victims were 14. The oldest were about 24. So those are the ages we're looking at. If you have someone like that in your life, you could call my desk number, which is 708 area code 865-6244. That's 708 area code 865-6244. Or you could go to the Sheriff of Cook County's website, and there's actually a form you could fill out if you think your loved one or friend is an unidentified Gacy victim.
The Vanished is sponsored by BetterHelp. With social gatherings picking up after the winter, it can be easy to ignore your social battery and spread yourself thin. It's a good time to think about the right amount of socializing for you. Maybe you thrive around people, or maybe you prefer more alone time. Therapy can give you the self-awareness to build a social life that doesn't drain your battery. A therapist can help you learn how to set boundaries so you feel empowered to be the best version of yourself. Everyone can benefit from therapy. It's not just for those who've experienced major trauma. So if you're thinking of starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online, so it's designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. Just fill out a brief questionnaire to get matched with a licensed therapist and switch therapists anytime for no additional charge. Find your social sweet spot with BetterHelp. Visit BetterHelp.com/vanished today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/vanished.
Everyone knows that finding the perfect t-shirt can be a challenge. I've always had problems, whether it was with the fit or quality. Luckily, the perfect t-shirt does exist, and you can find it at Skims. From cropped silhouettes to long-sleeve layering tees, there's a style for everyone. You know that I've been wearing Skims for a long time, and recently tried one of their t-shirts. It's the best-fitting tee I've ever worn. Skims makes the best basics and foundations. I got the boyfriend t-shirt in Onyx, and it's so soft and comfortable. I want to wear it every day. It literally fits like a dream. Shop the Skims t-shirt shop at skims.com, now available in sizes extra, extra small to 4X. If you haven't yet, be sure to let them know I sent you. After you place your order, select podcast in the survey and select my show in the drop-down menu that follows. Since this episode is a bit different, I wanted to do some research about how unidentified persons are given their name back. We were fortunate enough to sit down and talk with Dr. Colleen Fitzpatrick, who co-founded the DNA Doe Project with Dr. Margaret Press. You may have heard about their successful identification of Marsha King, who was known for many years as the Buckskin Girl. We had so many questions. But first, we wanted to hear a bit about her background and what the DNA Doe Project has been up to recently.
My name is Colleen Fitzpatrick. I am one of the executive directors of the DNA Doe Project, and we are dedicated to using genetic genealogy to identifying John and Jane Does. We've had several really nice success stories. Probably our most notable one, or our easiest one, was Buckskin Girl. She was a Jane Doe found in 1981 in Troy, Ohio. She was found within 24 hours of when she had been strangled and left by the side of the road. She gets her name from a buckskin jacket she was wearing when she was found. Everything had been done to try and identify her. They tried, you know, her DNA in CODIS. They tried fingerprints. They tried pollen analysis of the pollen on her jacket. They tried isotope analysis of the isotopes in her body, her bones, and nothing worked. So we got the case from Elizabeth Murray, who I think is at St. Joseph University in Ohio, in Cincinnati, Ohio. We had the DNA sequenced. We made a GEDmatch kit out of it. We did genetic genealogy, and we identified her within 4 hours. She had been unidentified for 37 years. That identification was based on a blood sample that they had kept for 37 years. It had been unrefrigerated, and it had been mixed with heparin, which is an anticoagulant. And still, it yielded great DNA, and we were able to identify her as Marsha Lenore Sussman King from Little Rock, Arkansas.
Many of us in the true crime community are familiar with the DNA Doe Project's successful identification efforts in long-term unidentified cases. We wanted to know how her organization started and about the origins of genealogical DNA.
This started in about 2000 when a few entrepreneurs realized that DNA could be used to identify relatives in the absence of, in the genealogy relatives, in the absence of documentation. So a number of companies were launched back then, basically mainly to use Y-DNA to help trace the family line. So, for example, I had my brother, Fitzpatrick, is his name, tested to see if we could find relatives out there that I didn't know about simply because the Y-DNA follows the male line of the family like the family name. So when this happened, the genealogists borrowed those Y markers from the forensic community. so that, you know, I realized sometime in 2011 that it would be not so hard to take a Y profile on a cold case and match it to the Y DNA databases that were online through the genetic genealogy community. So since then, I've been able to provide last names on various cold cases and help solve them. When 23andMe came about in, say, 2006 or so, that was a different kind of test, and that was not borrowed from the forensic community. That was borrowed from the medical community. 23andMe started testing SNPs and testing SNPs for, you know, medical conditions, whatever you want to say about that, but started also testing them for genealogy. So the basic way that worked was that you take, let's say, 600,000 SNPs or points on the DNA, and you put that into your database, and you see how many points each person shares with how many other people, and that tells you how closely they're related. So that if I did this and I found somebody that shared, say, 10% of my points, they'd have to be around a first cousin or so. So that was starting to use DNA along all lines of the family. So as time advanced and those databases got bigger, there became an interest in using those for forensic cases. But the direct-to-consumer DNA companies wouldn't go there. They didn't want to do forensic cases, and there are many reasons for that, including Fourth Amendment search and seizure issues, privacy concerns, and so on. So about a year ago, I know Margaret and I, and let's say there were a few other groups, there had been a lot of talk about using the forensic community, you know, became aware of these large databases. They wanted to use them. The direct-to-consumer companies wouldn't allow that. But at the same time, the genealogists realized the value of reaching out to the forensic community. There had been a number of genealogists that had gotten their DNA whole genome sequence. So they got the whole thing analyzed. And they had taken some software available and pulled out the markers that could be used for genetic genealogy and uploaded those to GEDmatch, an independent website not associated with the companies. And it worked fine. They didn't really have to go to the direct-to-consumer companies. They could go directly to this independent site called GEDmatch and do their analysis, find their DNA cousins. And there came a time when there was a genealogist whose father had died, and he decided to try the same thing using the DNA from the tissue of his father's biopsy. So instead of me going to give a sample or him going to give a sample, he brought his dad's tissue to the lab. They extracted DNA. They did whole genome sequencing. They did that software. They picked out the SNPs. They composed what was equivalent to an ancestry kit, uploaded to GEDmatch, and it worked like a charm. This was the first, you know, to my knowledge, example of somebody using this method on somebody who was deceased. So at that point, Margaret and I's light bulb went on. We could use this for John and Jane Doe's. And at the same time, I imagine the Golden State Killer people were realizing it could be used for suspect cases, as long as they didn't go through the direct-to-consumer labs. So the revolution started. We did, Joseph Newton Chandler was the first identification we did on March the 5th. And about 2 weeks later, I think like March 12th or 13th, we did Buckskin Girl. We identified her. She was the first public match doing this. And of course, the Golden State Killer happened after that. The revolution started. Now, because this whole process was borrowed from the medical industry and not the forensics, the forensic community is now trying to get their head around it, trying to understand how to use it, trying to understand the challenges, trying to make sense out of it so they can use it in a general sense to solve their cold cases.
I heard Dr. Fitzpatrick mention SNPs several times, but I didn't know anything about what that is, so we asked.
A SNP is a defect, just a point on the DNA that's changed. It's kind of like a typo in a book. If you can think of, you know, your DNA, AGCT, you know, the long little alphabet string, AGCT. If you think of that in terms of analogy of a book, a book will tell you somebody's life story, everything you really need to know about them, you know, that made their life story. DNA is kind of like your biochemical life story. And just like in a book, you have chapters in the story. In DNA, you have chapters called chromosomes. And each chapter, each chromosome tells part of that life story. And if you're missing a chapter, you're missing part of the story. And so when you write a book, it's possible you have typos in that book, and cat might turn into bat accidentally. Well, in DNA, the same thing happens, as you might, you know, have a letter in the DNA alphabet, and it's wrong. It changed. There was a typo when DNA went to divide, replicate. The cells divided and had to provide DNA to all the new cells, that there was a typo made that the DNA didn't catch. Now, believe it or not, DNA has a spell check, so that when the DNA divides, you know, and it's got to replicate itself to fill up the daughter cells, you know, so you have new cells and new DNA, that DNA has a spell check that goes back to make sure that the new DNA is the same as the old DNA. But sometimes the spell check misses a typo. So DNA sometimes misses something, and you have these typos built up, and those are called SNPs. If you didn't care where you're looking on the genome, they probably happen all the time. But if you sit at one point and you wait for that to develop a SNP, that one exact location, you're going to be waiting a long time. There's just tons of locations, 3 billion locations. So they say that as, you know, the human race has evolved, that there's a SNP probably one every 100th position. But most of the SNPs don't matter. You know, they're out in junk DNA. But occasionally, like in a book, you will have a typo that makes a big difference in the story. Similarly, that's when a SNP will occur in a gene and change that gene. So you might develop Parkinson's, or it might be the gene for some kind of protein or some kind of muscle development. And then a SNP happens in the middle of it, and it doesn't work the same way, and you can get sick. So those are not very many, but yeah, I think Parkinson's is one of them. A SNP occurs in the wrong place. I think breast cancer, somebody might correct me on that, but occasionally you will have a SNP just in the place you didn't want it, and that will cause that person to have some genetic disease.
Dr. Fitzpatrick told us how DNA from unidentified decedents is obtained, and what some of the current challenges are in obtaining samples from very old remains, as well as from persons of interest.
My understanding is that the power of attorney for that person is with the medical examiner or the DA's office. You know, I think it varies per agency and per state. You know what I'm saying? Let's say the medical examiner or the detective has the right to make the decision about the tissue sample, the bone, or the DNA of that deceased individual. First, you know, he's got to get permission from his own people that it's okay to proceed. And then we talk to him, you know, we talk to the lab, we talk to him, say, what do you have available? If they said, we have, you know, a 55-gallon drum of DNA. Okay, great. Send, you know, take a big scooper and throw it our way. All joking aside, if they had enough DNA, we could send it to our lab and do whole genome sequencing. And that means you get the whole genome, you pick out the SNPs, like I described, we put it on GEDmatch. The other route, if only a small amount of DNA turns out to be available, we can just do the chip, like, you know, an ancestry-esque chip, and just get the GEDmatch directly. You lose bells and whistles. You know, you lose stuff when you take that route, but still, it may be the only way to get it up on GEDmatch. If it's bone, we talk about a bone extraction, and there's a couple of ways we can do that. We work with several vendors, and we would help organize getting the bone sample to the bone extraction people, stay on top of it. And when it was done, we put ourselves as points of contact. So when it's done, we know it's done too, not just the agency. And then we can talk to the agency about getting it sent to the right place, you know, whether it's enough DNA for whole genome sequencing or chip. And then once we have that at the lab, then, you know, we go through our quality check, our sequencing or chip analysis, and then GEDmatch and all of our sanity checks in the middle. And serial killers won't spit in a little cup. You kind of wish they would, but So, you know, we get blood samples. That's great. We get tissue samples. We've had bloody clothing. We get a lot of skeletal remains. And in those cases, if DNA has already been extracted from the remains, we send those out to whatever company. Then we work with several companies on that. And they try to extract the DNA from the bones. You can get a lot of DNA. If you're lucky, you can get little itsy-bitsy amounts of DNA. You can get, maybe the DNA is degraded. You don't know. So the challenges are, you know, to understand first what sample you have available, to know how to route that sample the way you can maximize, you know, your ability to solve the case. And then to let the sample pass quality check and see if it's highly degraded.
After the DNA from either the unidentified person or the person of interest is obtained, what happens next? And in the case of our Jane Doe, what are the chances that she would have living relatives in a genealogical DNA database? Dr. Fitzpatrick answered some of those questions.
She should be like 20-something. Okay, let's say 20 years old, and it's been, what, 46 years. So she would have been 66. So likely you will find her, you could find first cousins. You could probably find aunts and uncles who were older, you know, 20 years younger. There's plenty of 80 years old people walking around. If she had a very large family, you might find an aunt and uncle that's about her same age. Her parents might still be alive. Her grandparents certainly are gone. Actually, there's a lot besides, you're going to come up with your DNA cousins, right? And as I said, people her same age would be her siblings, her first cousins. Those people probably have children and grandchildren. So you'd more likely come up with a first cousin once removed, first cousin twice removed, second cousin. Maybe the parents, but probably not. And besides that, just to mention that even you don't get nice relatives like that, you can do things like look at where all those matches are from and find maybe some geography where she could have been from. You know, if you see all the matches, like with Belle in the Well, and there was some idea she may have been from Alabama, Georgia, and stuff like that, because the publicity campaigns they had to try and identify her, she was found in Ohio and, you know, associated with West Virginia and stuff. Nobody came forward, but when we did the GED match, we found all of her matches, almost all of them were from West Virginia. So if you don't get close cousins, you can get some kind of geography of the origins of the family of your unknown. You can get the ethnicity estimates they have. Are my parents related is another thing that you can find that's, you know, specific to certain populations in the country. I worked on a case in North Carolina where we knew the father was from the Carolinas in the western part of the state, where they heavily intermarried, but his parents were not related. And that tipped me off that his father probably left the area to be in the military and met the mother somewhere else. You know, what's the chance that two people walking down the street in that area would meet and not be related? It was very small. So that's how I figured that out, and I was exactly right.
Now that we know that there's a very high chance that our Jane Doe will have some DNA relatives in the database, we asked Dr. Fitzpatrick to share how the DNA is analyzed and to explain what DNA sequencing entails.
What we're doing, it's really interesting that we say, this is how we handle it. If somebody came to us and said, just, I have, you know, enough funds, I'm okay, we would say $2,700, not to exceed $2,700. But 1K of that is an administration fee, and that just pays our bills. Nobody in our organization gets paid. So if we come to an agency and the agency says, well, yeah, we got some money, we can waive that admin fee. That's not going to be a problem, you know, if they really are broke. And then for an agency that has nothing, we can do a GoFundMe fundraising campaign. Once the DNA has passed quality check and we know we have something to work with, we won't raise money if the DNA is real bad and something's wrong with the mixture. You know, our quality control shows it's just too degraded or too low quantity. We just can't proceed. We won't raise money for that. The, you know, mixture's downstream a little bit. And so at that point, we'll put a PayPal button up and we'll go from there. that's what we do. We have three different levels, and we try to accommodate work with any agency, no matter what. And the reason we say not to exceed is because the pipeline in the lab, you put the DNA in one side and out comes the answer in the other. There's, pipelines that companies have developed to make themselves efficient. But we've come across some labs that are willing to do a little bit outside the pipeline if it saves us money. If you have really good DNA, it turns out we don't need to sequence as hard as with smaller amounts or degraded DNA. So that means we can reduce the cost.
Another kind of testing that we often hear about in John and Jane Doe cases is isotope testing. Dr. Fitzpatrick told us a bit about that, too.
My background is nuclear physics, so I can speak the language of stable isotopes. And I think that the stable isotopes are actually valuable. They don't really tell you who the person is, but they do tell you kind of the range, the geography of where the person has been, more like, what food they were eating as a child when their teeth formed. That locks into your enamel for the rest of your life. That never changes. That's one part of the body that is never remodeled throughout your life. Your long bones get remodeled every 10 years so that the isotopes in your femur give you some hints on where this person was during the last 10 years. The ribs remodel every 2 years. The hair grows out maybe a centimeter a month. So you have a record in your body of where you've been, kind of water you've drunk, the kind of food you ate, whether it's more vegetarian or whether meat, fish, that kind of food, where you've taken a shower, part of the isotopes in your hair. So I think, valuable, and also changes. Your hair, you can see if somebody's moving around a lot. You can see that as their hair grows out. So I think that's a fascinating area. And I think as more isoscapes are developed that are more accurate and sort of more focused to particular reasons, I think that's very valuable. It won't exactly identify the person, but it does give you some information on where they've been. It, no matter what evidence you have, it always helps. You take it and you kind of think about it and you try to massage it into the, see if it's consistent. Because no matter what you have on a John and Jane Doe, it's whenever you get it, it's something more than you knew 5 minutes earlier. You're starting with a blank. In the case of Buckskin Girl, that was interesting because she hitchhiked a lot. The isotope said she had been out to California, down into Texas, and the pollen said she had been up to Pittsburgh area, like along the Alleghenies, because of the pollen from the fir trees that were in her kinds of fir trees that were in that buckskin jacket. In that case, you got to think she could have borrowed the jacket or bought it at a flea market, the day before. You don't know that, but it's something more than you knew 5 minutes earlier. And, if it comes out, let's say she's basically been in the Midwest, then that tells us something.
Jane Doe's case is one that we followed for many months, getting frequent updates from Deputy Coroner Brandon Johnson. We spoke with him again just last week to find out where her case stands and what the next steps are for her in the identification process.
In the meantime, as we await for the results to return from UNT, we are working with NAMIS with an updated list of about 10 missing female African-Americans from around that time frame. They're going to be working with their odontologist to compare the dental records of their missing 2 hours for those that have the dental records. And then as we await the return, we're going to be working with USF for isotope testing. Also, after everything is returned from UNT, we'll be working to do genealogy with the DNA Doe Project. So as mentioned, previously, we've always sort of felt that it's such a great match, the pertaining to the missing a female from the Englewood area in Chicago. The mother's elderly, and I was hoping that maybe we would have a match on that. I'm hoping that we will be able to give her some more definitive answers. Hopefully we'll be able to tell her that it's her daughter once we hear back from UNT. hoping that maybe there was just some sort of error in the DNA with the sweater mix.
So who is Grundy County Jane Doe, and how did she end up in a ditch in rural Illinois? Who wanted to kill her? Why wasn't she reported missing, or was she? I was fortunate enough to obtain the records from the original investigation in 1976, and the authorities in Grundy County did everything they could at the time, including retaining samples, taking fingerprints, and contacting state and federal law enforcement agencies for assistance. But no one knew who she was. After the investigation turned up nothing, officials laid her to rest in a local cemetery, where she remained until December of 2018, when she was exhumed for advanced DNA testing. The hope is that once her DNA tests are completed, that she will finally be identified. At the time of her murder, Jane Doe was between 15 and 27 years old. She was a black female between 5'7" and 5'9" tall, and weighed between 130 and 150 pounds. Authorities have estimated that she died approximately 24 hours before she was found on October 2, 1976. She was found nude with a plastic bag and sweater around her head. If you visit thevanishedpodcast.com, I've added pictures of the sweater as well as what it's believed that Jane Doe looked like prior to her death. I'm asking that you share her picture or share her story so we can help Jane Doe get her name back. If you have any information about Jane Doe's identity or murder, you can contact Grundy County Deputy Coroner Brandon Johnson at 815-941-3359 or email him at bjohnson@grundyco.org.
You know, it's weird for most of us to think that someone could disappear, go unreported, and not be reported missing. You know, in most of our lives, there's someone. There's someone that would notice if we were gone. And if we were gone, they would eventually, hopefully quickly, make the proper reports to, whether it be to other family members or friends or whoever it may be, but and then eventually law enforcement. But some people don't have anybody. Some people are in a life circumstance where they just don't have anybody to report them missing. Or by time someone does recognize that they're gone, sometimes it's too late. You know, it's very hard for law enforcement when someone walks into a police station or calls on the phone and says, I had a friend or I had an uncle that is missing. I last spoke to him or last saw him or her 8 years ago. We just don't know where he's at. He may have been someone who traveled the country, maybe didn't always keep a fixed address for a long period of time. I'd like to report them missing. Well, a lot of law enforcement agencies will look at that person and go, what do you want us to do with it? Did he live within our jurisdiction? Well, I don't know, but he traveled through here a lot. Well, he's not really our missing then. Or even if they could establish some sort of residence within a town, they'll say, you know, how do you know they're really a missing person? If they were transient or didn't keep an address for a long period of time, how do you know they're missing? Maybe they're out there and alive. We're not going to accept this report. So it is weird to think, but that there is people in the country that just don't have anybody to report them missing, or their life circumstance makes it hard for someone to establish that they are missing. But the unidentified, if they can't be kept above ground until identification, they got to be buried in a place where that's dignified and that you know you could get back to, you know, because who knows in 10 years what the new scientific test is going to be. They're doing incredible things with isotopes and pollen and all of these other sciences and bacteria in our bodies, and you know, talking about that being the new DNA, microorganisms. So if these bodies can't be kept above ground while they're being identified or investigated, then at least a grave where you could get back to them again reasonably easy, you know. And it's not hard to do. It's just you got to be thoughtful of it, but it's easy not to care about someone who doesn't have a name. Well, that could be anyone's child.
That brings us to the end of episode 161. I'd like to thank everyone who worked with us on this episode. If you have a missing loved one that you'd like to have featured on the show, there's a case submission form at thevanishedpodcast.com. If you'd like to contact me, there's a page and a discussion group on Facebook. I'm on Twitter at thevanishedpod and also on Instagram. If you enjoy this show, subscribe now and leave a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Wondery.com, or wherever you're listening right now. Do you want to help support the show? There's a couple things that you can do. One way to help The Vanished is by supporting our sponsors. You can find links and promo codes in the episode notes. Another way to support the show is by filling out a short survey at Wondery.com/survey. Join me next week for another case from Illinois. Thanks for listening.
Whether you're working out, walking, or running errands, Audible can help you keep your heart rate up month after month with their pulse-pounding collection of thrilling audiobooks that you can't hear anywhere else. As an Audible member, you can choose one title a month to keep from their entire catalog, which includes thousands of titles. This month, check out the Audible original, The Space Within. It's a chilling 8-part story about a psychiatrist, Dr. Maddie Weil, voiced by Academy Award winner Jessica Chastain, who is tasked with unlocking the memories of a child who went missing for 7 hours. Maddie soon discovers that there are more who have faced similar experiences, and the truth of what is happening to them may impact the fate of humankind. New members can try Audible free for 30 days. Visit audible.com/thrill or text thrill to 500-500. That's audible.com/thrill or text thrill to 500-500.
I understand that anybody who's paid attention to the media would have to come to the conclusion that I killed my wife.
Hi, my name is Zach Stewart Pontier. I'm one of the filmmakers behind The Jinx, and I'm excited to bring you the official Jinx podcast. We'll be revisiting all 6 episodes of Part 1 and watching along with Part 2 as it airs on Max, starting April 21st.
Bye-bye.
The official Jinx podcast. Listen on Max or wherever you get your podcasts.